Go ahead and open your Bibles to Acts chapter 6. Those of you who have been here, you know we've been looking at maybe some stories or individuals that are not quite as familiar in our Bibles, individuals of not the greatest character, and trying to pull good lessons from those individuals. And we've stayed in the Old Testament for the first three lessons. We're going to venture into the New Testament. It is a chore to try to find individuals that this congregation does not know about. And so my guess is you know the individual we're going to look at in the New Testament. Much harder to find someone you don't know about in the New Testament. And I even had to cheat a little bit in the New Testament and name the names of the 10 spies last week. But the value of the study is really is the application of the lesson. And so today we are going to look, we're going to start in Acts chapter 6. And in Acts chapter 6, we find that the church there in Jerusalem is growing. It is flourishing. In fact, some accounts suggest that the number of Christians in the congregation there was perhaps as large as 20,000. But there was a problem that started to happen because the church was growing so much in terms of its number. The apostles were busy. They were teaching the gospel as they were instructed to do by Jesus. And it was difficult for them to attend to the needs of the people. And so the solution was to do what? All right, to identify seven men to do the job. And in Acts chapter 6, verses 5, it actually lists the seven men. But you all know of one of them. What's the name of the one individual that you all know? Stephen. Okay, and we know Stephen was a gifted preacher. And he was very bold and had no problem telling people what he felt he should tell them. And in fact, he was so bold that in chapter 6, verse 11, he was accused of what? Blasphemy. Blasphemy specifically of what? Blasphemy against what? Moses and God. Okay. And so because he was accused of blasphemy against Moses and God, he was sent before, if you have the New King James, it says the council. If you have the English Standard Version, it probably also says the council. Some of you may have another version, but who was that before? The council. Who was that? The Sanhedrin. And so he goes before the Sanhedrin, and in chapter 7, we have his defense. And you all know that his defense. What was his defense, basically? What was his defense? Was he the one that was blaspheming against Moses and God? No. Who was? They were. His defense was, it's not me, it's you. In fact, your fathers have been doing it forever. If you go back in time, your fathers have failed to follow God. Your fathers have, in fact, they failed to follow Moses. And we actually learn quite a bit about Moses that we don't learn in other parts of the Bible here in Acts chapter 7. But it was your fathers that failed to follow Moses. It was your fathers that failed to follow God. And so it should be no surprise that you have failed to follow Jesus. And so in Acts chapter 7, we pick it up in verse 51. He says to them, "You stiff neck and uncircumcised in the heart and ears." How did David refer to Goliath? Does anyone remember? How did he refer to Goliath? Uncircumcised. Who's this uncircumcised Philistine? And how does Stephen refer to the Sanhedrin? Uncircumcised in the heart and the ears. Isn't that interesting? He says, "You stiff neck and uncircumcised in the heart and the ears, you always resisted the Holy Spirit. As your fathers did, so did you. Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One." Who's that? Christ. Okay. of whom now you have become the betrayers and murderers, who have received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it. They took this news pretty well, right? Okay. So verse 54, when they heard these things, they were cut to the heart. They gnashed or grinded their Adam with their teeth. Verse 57, they cried out with a loud voice. They stopped their ears, or they covered their ears, and they ran at him or rushed at him together. And then what did they do? Dragged him outside the city, and what? And before they stoned him, what did they do with their clothes? They laid it at the feet of a young man named Saul. And I remember maybe when I was these guys' age, studying this story and thinking, you know, he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I remember maybe even we were given an assignment when I was in junior high to teach a 5-minute lesson, and I used this verse to teach a lesson about how we needed to be careful about who we kept our company with and how you needed to be careful about not being in the wrong place at the wrong time, which is a good lesson. But as you all know, this is where those silly little chapter divisions will get you. Because what do we learn in Acts chapter 8, verse 1? Saul was what? Yeah, I just didn't keep reading. I think, what is it, Dan? The ABCs of studying Scripture, right? Before and after and context. And I just didn't read the after. He was consenting or approving of his death. And so we continue to learn. What do we learn in chapter 6, the beginning of chapter 6? The church was what? It was flourishing. It was multiplying. It was doing great. And in Acts chapter 8, what was going on? Persecution. And who was leading the persecution? Saul. And so in Acts chapter 8, verse 3, it says Saul was making what?
Havoc.
Or ravaging. Or some versions say destroying the church. And how was he doing that? He was entering into houses, dragging Christians, committing them to prison. And if you flip over to Acts chapter 9, it says, then Saul, still breathing threats in verse 1 and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked letters from him to the synagogues of Damascus, so that if he found anyone who were of the way, whether men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. What were the letters he was asking for? What does that mean? What was the letters he was asking of the high priest? I'm sorry?
Arrest warrants.
Arrest warrants. He was asking for the approval, the authority to arrest who?
Christians.
Okay. How do you know it was Christians? From the verse. They're of the way. Okay, let's talk about that. That's a phrase, or two words, I guess, that Luke uses 6 times in Acts. This is the first time we see it. He uses it 5 more times. How do you know what does that mean, the way?
The new way of life.
Okay, new way of life. How do you know it's Christians? What Jesus described himself as. I'm the way, the truth, and the light. What else? How else do we know it? What? Okay. And within the verse, it says that Saul was still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord. And then he was asking for permission to anyone who were of the way. How many ways are there? How do we know it's just one? The way. Okay. And so he's asking for arrest warrants to take anyone, to arrest anyone who's of the way or disciples of the Lord, and he's going to take them back to Jerusalem. Why back to Jerusalem? That's where the Sanhedrin was. Who did Stephen go in front of? The Sanhedrin. Okay. And it's this funny little thing that happens in Acts chapter 9. You see the power of the gospel where the biggest persecutor of the church, what happens to him? He's changed. He sees Jesus. Do what? He had a come to Jesus moment. And so in verse, then in verse 18, he's baptized, and in verse 20, he's teaching about the way. All right? And who does Jesus send to go see him? Ananias. And he was like, yep, I'm on my way. Right? So what does Ananias say when God asks him to go visit Saul?
He was scared to do that.
Yeah. No, you got this wrong, right? And this just tells you how well known Saul was in terms of what he was doing. He's like, in verse 13, I've heard from many about this man, how much harm he has done to your saints in Jerusalem. And here he has the authority from the chief priests to bind all who call on your name. But the Lord said to him, go, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear my name before Gentiles. And this is the first, Luke actually talks about Saul's conversion multiple times in the Bible. And this is one of the times. Does anyone know the other two times? Okay, in chapter 22. So what happens in chapter 21 in Acts? In Acts 21, what happens to Saul? What happens to Saul in Acts 21? He's what? He's arrested. Why is he arrested? He's accused of something, falsely accused. What's he falsely accused of? All right, he's falsely accused of going into the temple with who? Gentiles. Okay? And so he goes out in Acts chapter 22 to the mob to try to calm them down. And what's he say in Acts chapter, in Acts 22, he talks about his conversion. And he says in verse 21, he in recounting his conversion, he talks about what Jesus had instructed him to do. And in 21, verse 21, he was instructed to do what? Go teach the Gentiles. And then in Acts 26, he's giving his account to who? King Agrippa. And in Acts 26, in verse 6, verse 17, in sharing his account of his conversion to Agrippa, he talks about what Jesus said to him, and he said, I will deliver you from the Jewish people as well as from the Gentiles, to whom I now send you to open their ears in order to turn them from the darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness and sins and inheritance among those who are sanctified in faith to me. So what was Paul's job to do as he was instructed by Jesus? All right. And so in Acts 13, what does Paul start to do? How does he start to teach the Gentiles?
In the synagogue.
His practice tends to be he goes into the synagogues. But what's he start doing in Acts 13? He starts going on what?
Missionary
journeys, all right? And so we start seeing him going on these missionary journeys to go teach the gospel to the Gentiles. And so he takes his first missionary journey and then his second missionary journey and his third missionary journey. And his third missionary journey is between 53 and 57 AD. And it's on that third missionary journey that he stays in one place for 3 years. What's that one place he stays in for 3 years? And it's the longest place he stays on any missionary journey.
Ephesus.
Okay? And it's in Ephesus, when he's there for 3 years, that we find our final subject for our study. Took us a while, but we got there. All right? Who is that person? It's Demetrius. All right? And so tonight we're going to look at the story of, if I can find, this is going to shock you, I have some slides. All right? It was Labor Day, so I wasn't at work. All right? So we're going to look at Demetrius. Don't get excited. It's like two slides, and I stole them from David. All right. All right. So we're going to look at Demetrius. Before we look at Demetrius, I want to spend a moment talking about Ephesus. All right. Tell me what you know about Ephesus. This looks familiar, right? Okay. All right. It's his map. So, all right. Ephesus is right here. Tell me what you know about the city of Ephesus.
Major trade center for Asia Minor.
Okay. So major trade center for Asia Minor, right? This area here. All right, the Temple of Diana, which is one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. What else do we know? 300,000 people population. All right, it was one of the, maybe the fourth largest city in the world at that time. What else? What do we know about this Temple of Diana? Or what does that tell us? That there was something called the Temple of Diana. Or the Temple of Artemis is what they called it.
They believed in other gods.
Okay, they believed in other gods.
Not the God of the Bible.
Okay. What else? Okay. All right. So it maybe looked something like this. It was a huge huge temple about the size of a football field. If you look at different commentaries, you may or Google it, you may get different dimensions, but it was around 340 feet long and 160 feet wide and about 60 feet tall. And as Tracy said, it was used for multiple reasons. It was their place of worship. I'm going to caveat that. That's not how we would think about worship, right? It was a very different type of worship because it was idolatry. And there was priestess there to help you worship, which is not the way like we would worship. It was, you could also bank there. And it was also a place you could go for asylum if you made it inside the marble columns. It was 120 marble columns. And inside there was the statue of Diana, who was their god of fertility. Anyone know what how they thought Diana arrived on Earth? They reference it in chapter 19, verse 35, I believe it is. How did Diana arrive? I'm sorry? I didn't. Yeah, sent down from Zeus. Okay, that's what they believed. Okay, anything else on Ephesus? All right, they had a big theater there, which archaeologists have uncovered as well. It probably held 25,000 people. Okay. All right, so now let's look at Demetrius. So come back here. What do we know about Demetrius? Does anyone know anything about Demetrius? Silversmith. Okay. Anything else?
Businessman,
shrewd businessman. Anything else?
Very
Community organizer. All right. Well, let's look at how good of a community organizer he was. So look in Acts chapter 19. And let's start at verse 25. So what did Demetrius do? So he is he's a silversmith, verse 24, and he made silver shrines of Diana. And that brought him no small profit. That was how he made his living, and apparently he made a pretty good living on it. So we lived in, you know, right on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. We've been to New York. We've been fortunate enough to go to Europe. We have those miniature statues of the Eiffel Tower and the Statue of Liberty and the Washington Monument. I don't know why we have them, but we have them. And he made those of of the goddess Diana, and he made a good living doing it. And so he calls in verse 25. He calls together the workers of similar occupation, and he says to them, "Men, you know that we have our prosperity by this trade, making these silver Diana, these silver shrines of Diana." He says, "Moreover, you see and hear that not only at Ephesus, but throughout all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away many people, saying that they are not gods which are made with hands." All right, so what had Paul been doing? He had been traveling all through this area, establishing congregations and teaching that idols didn't work with God. In fact, if you look over in verse 18 real quick, what had been happening at Ephesus? Well, it turns out that there had been some Christians who were still practicing magic. And they realized that they couldn't keep doing that. And so in verse 18 it says, "And many who had believed came confessing and telling their deeds. And many of those who had been practicing magic brought their books together and burned them in the sight of all. And they counted up the value of them, and it totaled 50,000 pieces of silver." And so Paul, Paul was having effect in the region. And so Demetrius has gathered all these craftsmen together, and he says to him in verse 27, "Not only is this trade of ours in danger of falling into disrepute, but also the temple of the great goddess of Diana may be despised and her magnificence destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worship." Okay. So, I don't know if he cared about worshiping Diana, but he certainly cared about his money. He's gathered them all together. He's made this appeal to them. And how do they react in verse 28? They heard this and they're what?
They cried out.
Full of anger, full of wrath. They cry out, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." So he stirs them up. But he just doesn't stir them up. He just doesn't stir up the craftsmen. He stirs up the whole city. And so the whole city, it says in verse 29, was filled with confusion, and they rush into the theater with one accord, and they seize Gaius and Aristarchus, some of Paul's travel companions. Paul wants to go in to the city; they won't let him. Some of the officials of Asia they send to him and plead him not to go in. And then it says in verse 32, "Some therefore cried one thing and another, and some another, for the assembly was confused, and most of them did not know why they had come together. And they drew Alexander out of the multitude." The Jews put him forward. Who was Alexander? What was his background? He was a what?
Conqueror.
Is, Actually, Alexander the Great did spend some time here, but that's not who this was. He was who? He was a what? He was a Jew. So what are the Jews doing here? Why are they sending Alexander out to this basically mob in the city? Anyone know?
They wanted him to make a defense for them.
Yeah, they'd send him out to say, hey, we're not Paul. This isn't us. We have nothing to do with this. So that's why they're sending Alexander out. And what did all the Ephesians do? They let them get a word in? What did they do? They start chanting. What do they start chanting? They drown them out. Great is Diana of the Ephesians. For how long?
2 hours.
2 hours. They're chanting this.
I thought you said once they got into the temple, though, that was your safe place.
This is, they're in the theater outside, yeah. Okay. So the city clerk, who is an elected official, finally quiets the crowd. And he basically says, these men in the city, who are these men that you've taken, first off, he says, what man is there who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is the temple guardian of the great goddess Diana, and is in the image which fell down from Zeus? Therefore, these things can't be denied, and you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash. In other words, everyone knows that the temple of the great goddess Diana came from Zeus. No one's going to deny it. And that these men, verse 37, that they weren't robbers and they weren't saying anything against the goddess. So you have really no basis for taking them. And therefore, if Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a case against them, they should take it through the legal, the proper legal channels. The courts are open. That's how you should deal with it. And by the way, in verse 39, verse 40, you're all in danger for the uproar that you're causing. And so you need to basically disperse. And he dismisses assembly and they all walk away. And that's the story. So how long did you give me, by the way?
10 after.
Okay, plenty of time. All right. So, what is the lesson that we can take from this? And certainly, there's an aspect of this that we could talk about, Demetrius and his love of money, and there's a nice little symmetry to the way the classes were set up, where Nabal had a love of money, and he was the first one we looked at, and that was by design. But I actually don't think that that's our most interesting lesson we can learn from this story. I think there is something much more valuable we can learn from this story that Demetrius can teach us. Paul, I think it's very fair to say that Paul, as we often see, Paul loved the congregation and the Christians at Ephesus. We don't know if Paul established that congregation. Maybe he did in his second missionary journey. We see that he stopped there in Acts chapter 18. But as I said before, and as you all know, he spent 3 years there. He spent 3 years there. It was the longest time he spent on any missionary journey. When Paul was on his way to Jerusalem in Acts chapter 20, he met with some elders in another city, this one right here. He met with some elders in Miletus. Who are those elders? Where were they from? Ephesus. When he's in Rome in 62 AD, around there, he wrote a letter to the church at Ephesus. And when they were struggling, that church was struggling with false teachers having infiltrated them and impacting them, who did he send to Ephesus? Anyone remember? Sent Timothy. He sent Timothy to him. Why did Paul spend so much time in Ephesus? Why did he spend time with the elders, Miletus? Why did he send Timothy there? I mean, why did he care for them and love them so much? Look, we saw the same type of relationship he had with the Christians in Thessalonica. I mean, he left Thessalonica. He established that congregation on his second missionary journey. They left before he wanted to, and he wrote them 6 months after he left, and he sent Timothy there too, and he wrote them a second time. But he seems to care a lot about this congregation. And I'm going to suggest to you that he saw something in that congregation that Demetrius saw. So what was it Demetrius saw that maybe Paul saw?
That they hold a very large influence on the rest of the world.
Large influence on the rest of the world? The city of Ephesus had a huge influence. It was a large city, huge commercial. Okay. Yeah. Greek gods, huge influence in terms of the temple there.
The false gods.
Okay. So it was an opportunity. It was a huge opportunity. Okay. The people are already united and connected. Okay. What did Demetrius do to appeal to the people? I mean, he got the craftsmen together. And he said two things, and it sent all the craftsmen out into an uproar. What he basically say to them? He hit them with two things. What did he hit them with?
Money
and their religion, right? And the craftsmen, they went out into an uproar. They start chanting, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians," and then what did that turn into? A riot in the entire city. And when it turned into a riot of the entire city, they all started rioting. And not a single one of them had any clue why they were rioting. Does anyone notice that? Every single one of them was confused why they were doing it. But they grabbed all of Paul's people, and they're all in the theater, and they're all chanting, and Alexander stands up, and they just drown him out for 2 hours, and they don't even know why they're doing it, right? I mean, look at what the Bible says. Is so verse 29, so the whole city was filled with confusion. The whole city is filled with confusion. And they rushed into the theater with one accord, and they seized Paul's companions. Verse 32, some therefore cried one thing, and some other, for the assembly was, and some another, and for the entire assembly was confused. And most of them didn't even know why they'd come together. And it all started because Demetrius said, we're going to lose all our wealth, and we're no longer going to worship Diana. And I don't know if he really cared about Diana, but he knew how to stir them up, and he knew how to confuse everyone. And what does that suggest about the people?
He could see the threat.
See the thread. The threat. Oh, yeah, he absolutely saw the threat. But what's it suggest about the people? And I also want you to remember this. Paul was going around teaching and preaching people in the area, but what happened in verse 18? There's a bunch of Christians that showed up and said, I'm still practicing magic. What's it suggest about the people? How easily were they influenced? Very easily influenced. So what's that suggest about how strong their foundation was?
Not very strong.
Not very strong. So I want you to think for a second about the Hebrew writer who is trying to explain to the recipients of his letter about who Melchizedek is. And he says, I can't tell you who Melchizedek is because you're what? By now you're supposed to be a what? A teacher. But you're not ready for this because you still need what? You still need milk. You're not ready for solid food. You haven't moved on from the first principles of... Okay. So now I want you to think back to everything that Paul was doing. Okay? He spent 3 years there. He spent time with the elders in Miletus. He sent Timothy there. Why was Paul doing all that? Listen, I'm sure he loved them and cared for them. But could it have been because he knew where they were located and that they did not have the foundation? Could it have been because he knew the pressures that they were under and he knew that he needed to spend all that time with them because they did not have the foundation? And so what's the lesson for us? What's that tell us about how important a foundation is? Okay. So something for you to think about. There's a little bit of conjecture on our part there.